Is This a Ghost is sponsored this week by longtime listener and super fan Bonnie Miller.
Oh, Bonnie.
Say some words to Bonnie. Yeah,
I want to hear what you have to say about Bonnie first.
Well, Bonnie was so taken with our 10th anniversary message for Chris and Allison, who, by the way, I have not heard from.
Ooh,
and it's been weeks. So I don't think that was well received. But once again, no refunds.
This is, again, ladies and gentlemen at home, this is why you cash out your Venmo account the instant you get money in it. You don't let the money sit in there.
100%. The second I get that notification, I don't have many apps that I let send me notifications. Venmo is the big one because I'm taking that money as soon as it hits. But Bonnie heard that, and unlike Chris and Allison, she loved it. And she said, I need to get in on this. And so she has now sponsored an episode. And I said, this is so great. Do you have anything you want to say? And she said, no. And I said, can we, okay.
Like a hint, maybe?
So I said, it does help if we can have something to talk about.
Yeah.
Because we don't know Bonnie.
Right.
So it's hard,
sure,
it's hard to extol her virtues other than she is very free with her money, which we're so grateful for. So I asked her, I said, so what do you, is there anything, is there something you plug for you, whatever? She said, no, I don't like have anything to sell or anything. But she said, she works for a small community theater. And so she said, she would like to encourage people just to go out and to donate to your local nonprofits because, a lot of them are still having a really hard time recovering from COVID. Mm-hmm. So she sent here, put some money in your local community and get involved.
I love that.
Really nice.
I love that.
It's really nice. Speaking of someone who has worked in theater, in performing arts management for a long time, I love that. And here's what I found out about Bonnie. So I said, well, where do you work? Because she didn't even say, like, give it to my organization, which she works for one.
Sure.
And but so I said, well, where do you work? And she said she works at a theater company called Richmond Civic Theater, which is in Richmond, Indiana.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Always confused. And I said, hey, I know Richmond, Indiana.
How?
Because Richmond, that's a great question. Richmond, Indiana is where, when I was moving from Chicago to near Richmond, Virginia, which is why I remember the name of the town.
Right.
I was in the car with our friend Dave and my two cats and half of my stuff, half the car transportable stuff, and our tire blew.
Oh, I remember.
And it
this.
Blew as we were going on the interstate past Richmond, Indiana. And there was a really great set of folks at the tire shop, the R&R tire shop in Richmond, Indiana, who came out to our car, changed the tire, because he was like, we're changing. He goes, don't worry about changing the tire as we're on the interstate. And I said, don't worry.
Yeah.
Didn't enter my mind
not in the
to
cards.
Do so. These cars are going super fast.
I am really scared and mostly useless.
So they changed it and they followed us back to their spot. They let us bring, while they worked on the car to get us a brand new tire, they actually did all the tires for us. They let us bring the cats into the shop.
Oh,
and
wow.
Like, it's really hot outside. Bring your cats in. And I said, thank you so much. They're in a big carrier. They go, oh, even better.
Yeah.
So I think they were going to just let the cats run around.
If there's anything cats love more than the air hammer tools of a tire shop, I really can't think of it. It's just,
almost nothing, I'd say.
It's like the jungle for them. It's like, finally.
So they also like drove us to lunch while our car's being worked on. It was the wildest experience.
You bought lunch though, right?
Yes, we did. Well, we bought lunch for one of the guys. Yeah. it's a really nice, if you're going to blow a tire on the, near the Indiana Ohio border, try to position yourself as close to Richmond as possible because great folks. And, one of those great folks who lives in that town is Bonnie Miller. And you should support her theater, Richmond Civic Theater, and you should support any local theater or local charity that's near you. And I thought maybe to help kind of encourage that, Patrick, you could do a pitch.
Right.
Of like, just to really, I mean, really inspire people. Like channel your Coach Waltz and just really get people to get fired up to give.
Like now?
Yeah, yeah.
Sure, okay.
You ready? Or,
oh,
okay,
man. Yeah. So, folks, I know times are tough. I mean,
times are tough, aren't they?
And the economy is actually doing really well, and wages are...
it's really on the upswing. And
wages are kind of an all-time high. Unemployment is just almost zero. So I guess times are actually pretty good, unless Unless you are kind of a crappy community theater, then maybe maybe
she's paid $25. You can't call her work crappy. No,
hers isn't. I'm sorry. You're talking about my local.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, yeah. Great. Okay, thank
it's God. Very like very local. Yeah, I'm sure Bonnie's is great, but you know it probably needs help. So you know maybe go there. You know, bring $5, $6, $7. I don't know what it costs any of these things nowadays. buy some popcorn. Buy some.
Do you have popcorn?
Probably. I think they do. Or is that not a theater thing? But you know, buy a beer or a wine.
Have you ever been to a community theater?
I have no idea what's going on.
I'm starting to think that maybe like, you don't know what you're talking about.
It's in
about.
Like a cafeteria, right? That's the community.
I mean, sometimes. Hey, listen. Sometimes yes. Yeah. Sometimes it is.
But yeah, you know, really just, no matter how hard life is, there's always time for you to give, to, you know, to buy popcorn. And there we go.
Boy, I regret that instantly. so we're going to cut all that. And, listen, so you do Bonnie a favor, do us all a favor and go support your local theater, your local charity. Or if you don't want to do the work to find out what the URL is where you would do that, you could go support Bonnie's theater, which is at GoRCT.org, stands for Richmond Civic Theater, GoRTC.org. Go there and throw them a few bucks. Even $5 is meaningful. It's not hugely meaningful, but it is some money, and that's nice. But if you give $20, you can give $100, you could give, I'll tell you what, Patrick's going to give $1,000. He's going to match up to $1,000.
Over time.
Right here
over
tonight.
Time. Yes. I mean, it's a long time thing. Maybe like $1.
It's $1 a week for every the next 1,000 weeks. Yeah. And eventually that's going to really be something for them.
Yes.
So go support Bonnie. Go support the Richmond Theater. Go ahead, Patrick. I can't wait to hear the final word on this.
Anyone that wants to match my donation of $1 every few weeks when I find it for the next 1,000 weeks, I will send you a special email.
I think we just saved the arts.
Yeah.
Welcome back to Is This a Ghost? I'm Clayton Smith, and every single week I tell a real ghost story from real history to my real friend, Patrick Dean, who doesn't take it real seriously.
No, this week especially not.
I don't know if you listened to the intro, the ad break, but yeah, especially this week. You okay?
Pensive. Pensive this week.
Why are you pensive?
I don't know, stomach maybe?
Okay. How's your week going? What? It's Monday. We're on our regular night.
Thank God. That Wednesday business.
That's brutal, huh?
No, thanks.
I will say Jeremy turned around that audio in like 36 hours. It was awesome. Thank you as always to Jeremy Montoya for just doing such a good job, for nothing. Mm-hmm. Except for that $50 gift card we gave him that one time.
Yeah.
That was pretty nice.
That was pretty good. I hope he likes Crate and Barrel. is there like a worse gift card to give somebody than like $15 to Crate and Barrel or something like
thanks.
That?
Now I will spend $98 at Crate and Barrel.
This will cost me more money to burn this.
Oh man. your basement looks pretty furnished by Crate and Barrel, right? How many pieces in your basement are
there are, some, like there are some there's some crates. Tree. Yeah, that's a crate.
there's a barrel somewhere.
There's some barrels in the back, mostly with pickles.
Piece of a barrel.
Yeah, pieces of barrels.
Pickle barrel. Man, I'd pay $98 for a good pickle barrel. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of pickles in a barrel.
It is, but you know what? They'll last forever. Pass them down to your grandchildren.
These are Papa's pickles. Oh, man. How was your weekend? What'd you do? What'd you do this weekend?
Went to the old Festival of Nations. Have you been?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that was this weekend.
Food trucks, right?
Well, food stands. But yeah, from every kind of ethnic food that St. Louis can produce.
Which is actually a lot.
Yeah, there's I mean, it's 80 some odd different countries.
All jokes aside. Yeah. Yeah, it's like the Epcot Center of the Midwest.
It really
is what they
is.
Call St. Louis.
Mm-hmm. It absolutely is. Except you can get as drunk as you want, and they can't throw you out. So it's pretty cool that way.
I could throw you out.
They could try.
um, That's cool. Mm-hmm. What did I do this weekend? What is today?
Today's Monday-ish. Yeah.
Boy, I got to sleep more. I don't know what we did this weekend. But, I do have a story about tonight. So I was doing bed. We're recording a little bit later than normal because I was doing bedtime because Aaron was out. And so I was all alone. And I put the girls to bed, and it all went okay. Mm-hmm. Until a few minutes after Ivy was definitely asleep, Mabel called me into the room. Mm. And so I went in there. I said, "What's going on?" And she said, "Daddy, I'm really scared." And I said, "What are you scared of?" And she said, "I don't know." And I said, "Okay, well, that doesn't give me a lot to work with." Yeah. But I said, "Well, you don't have to be scared because our family has a lot of family magic. And we love each other so much that we make this magic. And it protects the whole house. Mm-hmm. And nothing scary can get in this house."
Right. Yeah.
And she said, "Okay, but a voice in my head keeps telling me that the giant purple fish is going to eat us." And I said, "What?" And she said, "I know it's not real, but I keep hearing in my head that the giant purple fish is going to eat us all." And I said,
"Huh." "Thanks. Now it's in my head, Mabel. So appreciate that."
So that's what I'm dealing with now, mentally speaking. God. I don't know. So I think we may actually have a malevolent spirit in our house because that's a very specific very whisper pointed. That is very pointed, very tailored to me and my biggest fears.
Mm-hmm. Color purple.
So, yeah. Oh, God. And that stems from watching all those Grimace commercials.
Oh, okay.
As a young child. Just fucking Grimace. Terrifying. Oh, man. There was something else I was going to tell you today. What was it? Write it down.
Were you going to comment on the most insane and distasteful political ticket of all time suddenly getting 1,000 times more insane and politically distasteful?
I know it'll solve the weird thing. Let's put brain worms on the ticket.
Brain worms, severed whale heads, and dead bear cubs are on the ticket.
I don't know why I should be surprised about the severed whale head story, but it's just like, God, I think what's more surprising about these things is like, how have we not known this?
Yeah.
It's like, these are years ago. How has this been secret until now?
I'm just imagining whatever guy whose job is like, he's the fixer for the Kennedy family. Like the guy that makes sure none of this shit comes out. He is just sitting there at home watching this on TV. Like, do you know how many months of my life were spent covering up the whale head story, mopping up miles of I-94.
God, the girl and the whole story is like, yeah, I guess they interviewed Kick, and she was like, every time they accelerated, the whale juice escaped him. God, Jesus Christ. What if these are the things that are like surfacing? What are they actually working hard to keep suppressed?
It's almost like he's just like in public therapy right now. Like, I can just say anything, right? Well, yeah. I mean, you can, I guess. Oh, I'm so happy this is a safe spot to talk about this.
Oh, well, good for him. I'm glad he's getting it all off his chest. Boy.
I don't know whether he, well, I guess, yeah, the whalehead story didn't come out from him. That was from Kick, his daughter.
She is the one who?
Yes, she was the one that shared that story. So I was wondering who he was doing a podcast with this time that he decided to tell the whalehead story.
Who else is a terrible person who was made less terrible by this reveal of an RFK Jr. story? Well, that makes a lot of sense because now what's in the news lately is Kick and Ben Affleck are being seen together. Oh. So you know Kick is like, oh, we got to deflect this real quick. Here's a story about my dad.
I lost you for a while there.
Yeah. Well, I just said something that you didn't need to reply to, but maybe we should clap again just to...
Sure.
Why is my connection unstable? Is Erin using the fucking internet again? I told her that is for men only.
Erin, are you torrenting?
Are you watching porn without me again? I'm so mad. Let's clap. One, two, three. Yeah, seems like we're back on track. Yeah. Anyway, I was just saying that it makes sense because Kick has been in the news lately as being seen with Ben Affleck.
Sure.
So now she's the villain. She's like, I gotta change the headline, and I know just how to do it. Well, that's not what I wanted to share. And I'll think of it by the time we're done with this episode, for sure. And we'll bring it up, I don't know, in 3 weeks. Mm. In the meantime, do you want to hear a ghost story?
Love to. Oh. Pause the fucking thing.
Yeah, paused it.
How many of the Abraham Lincoln "You Are Not a Fish" shirts have we sold so far?
I will say this. It's not like we're going to pull back the curtain a little bit on Is This a Ghost? We're not as popular as a show as you might think we are. And so when I say that in the first 18 hours we've sold 6 shirts, it might not sound like very many.
That's as many shirts as I have.
It is so many. It is, I mean, by far outpacing any other shirt we've ever had. It's a good one. It's a good one. And one of our listeners just sent us a message. Did I send you the message, that the email that I got?
Mm-mm.
From a listener who bought 3 shirts. Like, within 3 hours of the shirt being released, she bought 3 shirts. And it's because she had that day been in the car with 2 of her colleagues. And she actually lives in Virginia.
Hmm.
And she works at a museum. And they were on their way to the beach, I think, for just to hang out. And they were, one of her friends was telling her about the story of the hiccup in the "You Were Not a Fish." Now, I don't know if that's because the friend listens to, because this is not a person I've heard from before.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if the friend listens to us, or that was just happenstance that she also heard that you could tell people they're not a fish. But she was like, and then like half hour later, I saw this, so I obviously bought 3 and everyone gets 1. So it is, we're really pushing the envelope on on esoteric shirts. And this is truly, I say this every time, but I think this is the best one yet.
It's the esotericist. I will say that.
It is the esotericist for sure. If you haven't seen it, go to the website, go to our store. It invokes the Uncle Sam, "I want you" for the U.S. Army, except it is Abraham Lincoln in Uncle Sam gear, except his shirt is open and he is ripped. Oh. He's ripped to hell and says, "You are not a fish." and it's really good. Yes, thank you for reminding me that we need to shamelessly plug that, because it is the best thing we've ever done, including the podcast itself. It's better than that. All right, now are you ready to hear a ghost story?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, play it.
Wham!
That's the wrong button.
No, that's fine. I like that button more, actually.
So, Oliver Hazard Perry Belmont.
Oof.
Was born on November 12th, 1858 in New York.
Ooh.
What's your favorite part of New York? You've been there a few times.
Ooh, man. The most comfortable part of New York is the gutter. That's my favorite. That's where I like to just kind of
lean back on the trash.
Take
the stacks of trash.
And just take a few minutes to myself. Gather my senses.
No one bothers me there.
No one bothers me down in the gutter.
That's great.
It's my favorite place. Second favorite is swimming at Coney Island. That's my second favorite place.
Oh, man. It is so cold there and so brown.
Oh, my goodness.
I don't know why.
It is. Yeah, it is not a color I realize ocean water could become.
It's the closest body of water I could name color-wise is, I guess, the Mississippi.
It is very rivery, yes.
Yeah, which I don't think is how oceans are supposed to be. Coney Island is the best. The freak show must still be there.
Has to be. I mean, where else would they go?
That's true. This is the last bastion. It's there or it's nowhere. Remember when Millie and I lived out there for that summer and we made friends with Eek the Geek?
I do.
God, that was a summer, huh?
Mm-hmm.
And then he would like walk with us after the shows out on the pier and read us some poetry. life is an adventure, huh? Anyway, so that's where Oliver Hazard Perry Belmont was born in 1858. Now, Oliver's father, August Belmont, he was a Hessian Jew who came to the U.S. in 1837 as an agent for the Rothschilds.
Mm.
So this is definitely going to sound racist. But it's just true that as such, he, quote, accumulated enormous personal wealth.
Mm-hmm. Someone has to accumulate it.
Yeah, someone's got to buy the first space laser. And it's going to be August Belmont. So when I say that he acquired enormous wealth, I would like to illustrate just how enormous that wealth was with a fun fact.
Wham!
You've probably heard of the Triple Crown horse races.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can you name the three races in the Triple Crown?
Belmont, Preakness, and Kentucky Derby.
Very good. Who do you think the Belmont Stakes is named after?
Ricky Belmont.
So close. So close. You got one of the names right.
Okay.
50%. It's named for August Belmont, for Oliver's father. Now, Oliver's mother, August's wife, obviously, was Caroline Slidell. She was the daughter of Commodore Matthew Perry. Anyway, this Perry was famous for commanding the naval expedition that opened Japan.
Oh, hey.
In 1853.
Historically locked up tight.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. I've seen that movie with Tom Cruise called, what is it? Last Samurai. Mm-hmm. I've seen that movie. I know all about how white people ruined yet another country.
Hey, can we come over here? I really don't think it's such a good idea.
It's going to be great. Just trust us. even though he lived in New York, Oliver attended school in Concord, New Hampshire. I assume this is like a classic boarding school thing. At the age of 14, he enrolled in the U.S. Naval Academy. He graduated from there 1 year late and near the bottom of his class. But you know what they call the person who graduates bottom of their class in medical school?
Doctor.
They call them doctor.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he was, of course, commissioned as an officer, but he was commissioned as a midshipman, which is the lowest rank of officer in the Navy.
You don't get to be in the front. You definitely don't get to be in the back. You're in the middle somewhere. You know, take care of middle stuff.
Middle. You're pretty mid. Yeah. This is actually where mid comes from. That one's for all our Gen Z listeners. So he's a midshipman, but then he resigns after 1 year.
No.
So he's very smart, very driven, and very interested in work. It's what we've learned about Oliver. In 1882, Oliver meets Sarah Swan Whiting.
Oh.
Now she's a popular socialite. And without telling his parents, he proposes marriage to her.
Hmm. Okay.
You ever think about, like, I hate to tell you this, but Stella's getting, I wouldn't say she's not at marrying age quite yet.
Right. She is a child. So I would say no.
Yeah. 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 I mean, well, hey, in some states, she's pretty close.
In Missouri. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, right. Oh, yeah. So you get it.
Yeah. We're one of those horrible states. Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't think you've ever, I assume you probably haven't thought about this yet, but what do you have any opinions on, like, if she came home and you're like, I'm marrying this guy, and you had never met this person, would that bother you, or you think you'd be okay?
Boy, I don't know. Does it mean she's moving?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, okay, so.
All right, so that's something
in the pro column. A little bit goes in that dish. A few little weights go in that dish. All right. I don't know. Well, I raised her to make good decisions. We'll put it that way.
Uh-oh. Wow, that's a nice save.
Now that sounds like a shitty decision, admittedly, but
maybe it's a really good shitty decision.
Yeah, I don't know.
Also, compared to some of your decisions, maybe it's a good one. We don't know. Yep. We don't know your life.
Mm-hmm. If she was like, I'm gonna marry this guy who has unimaginable wealth, I'd be like, that's great. I'm coming with you. I will take care of the pool or whatever he needs me to do. And that's fine.
I am not good at groundskeeping, but I will try. So where are we here? So now his parents were not on board.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't think he was, and it's not because they didn't know her. It was because they didn't think he was mature enough for marriage. He had a bit of a gambling issue. He seemed to like the drink a little too much and was just generally not very good at stuff.
Yeah. The midshipman thing kind of.
Yeah. Yeah. I included that to really set a tone. I'm glad you're picking up on. So the parents, so his parents break, they break up the engagement the best way that they could. They send Oliver to Germany to so that he can learn banking from the Rothschild family. Mm-hmm. So he goes to Germany, but while in Germany, Oliver becomes, quote, dissipated. Which is not a term I was familiar with.
I'm very unfamiliar.
It means overindulgent in sensual pleasure.
Oh, no.
One of those sensual pleasures is that he develops a pretty serious absinthe habit.
Oof. Okay.
And this is 19th century absinthe.
Mm-hmm. Which so is like it's, the real stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's pure it's, wormwood. Yeah.
Definite green fairy territory. Yeah. Absolutely.
Not just like vodka with blue food dye in it. Like it is nowadays.
Right.
Hey, did I ever tell you the story about the time I almost got myself in trouble with the pleasures of Germany?
No, but on behalf of our listening public, I would love to hear it.
So it's hard to explain. In some countries of the world, Germany being one of them, you don't make eye contact with people. You just don't. Like,
what about when you're talking to them?
When you talk to them, yes, absolutely. But with people on the street, like...
Oh, so you don't do, like, the walk past and nod and
right.
say,
oh. That's, you don't do that. That's not a thing that you do. Okay.
But so you're from the Midwest.
I'm from the Midwest. I say hello to everybody, right? Yeah. So me and some colleagues, when I was over there for work, you know, some years ago, me and some colleagues are getting some street food late at night.
Doner kebabs?
Doner kebabs, of course. Unbelievable. Mm. And I'm just, you know, like, you know, eating my street food, you know, bobbing my head on the sidewalk, looking around, whatever. And I see someone looking at me. And I kind of, you know, look back at this. It's a woman. She's looking at me. And I was like, oh, she must think I'm some sort of weirdo. So I, you know, make eye contact and smile and nod my head and go back to eating my food. And then I glance over again and this person's walking towards me. And I think,
this is why you don't make eye contact.
This is, now I get it. And of course, all of my friends or all my colleagues... they're looking at this woman walking towards us, and they know that this woman is not a friend of any of us. And they're like, we need to leave now because you have just attempted to engage with somebody that we don't really want to engage with on the streets of Berlin. So we had to leave. We had to literally leave. And this woman was, I'm sure, like, what kind of doofus is over here giving me the nod and then running away?
So you're anti-sex work.
At that moment, I was not interested. We'll put it that way.
Oh, man.
So, yeah, anyway, if you're traveling internationally, don't take for granted that eye contact and nodding and saying hello is...
Yeah. Is a yeah, it's important to understand the customs of where you're visiting. So he's got a pretty serious absinthe habit, and he's going totally off the rails. Mm. When his mom finds out about this, she's like, oh, okay, sorry. Okay, fine. Come back and get married. Yep. So he does. He comes back home. He marries Sarah at her family home of Swanhurst.
Hmm.
Which is not Swannanoa.
Okay, not Swannanoa.
But rich people fucking love Swan.
They do.
So much. They take their honeymoon in Paris. And of course, they're, you know, 19th century wealthy idiots. So mm-hmm. this is going to be like a 3-month honeymoon, which I think was pretty common for that set. Mm-hmm. So they're in Paris. But after a few weeks, Sarah's mother and her two sisters come to join them
honeymoon. Yeah. No, this is not okay.
I mean, Oliver's not going to be the hero of our story, but in this one instance.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard not to be on his side because he did not like that. Mm-hmm. Did Amy's mom come along on your honeymoon?
So it's funny you mention it. My not on ours, but my parents, who you'll be shocked to know, are no longer married to each other. when my parents are married, they went on a honeymoon to, of course, the Lake of the Ozarks. And
the jewel of central Missouri.
And they drove my uncle down in the truck with them because he was going fishing down there with some friends and needed a ride. And I asked my mom about this, you know, years later after I found out about this. I'm like, this wasn't just like a colossal red flag. She said, well, I was young and I was in love and I was like, you know, 19 years old or whatever. Didn't seem like a big deal to me.
My brother down.
My brother needs to come on our honeymoon, but just for the drive down to the Lake of the Ozarks. He's going somewhere else when we get down there.
I have to ask, did he go somewhere else when they
got
down there?
I don't think so. I think he probably stayed like a different bedroom of the cabin.
Oh, man. It's amazing they were together long enough to make two children.
It's wild.
It's really stunning. Good on them. Jesus Christ. So it's that sort of situation. Cool. Oliver does not like this, of course. Yeah. He took to frequenting gambling houses and brothels, drinking absinthe to escape the situation. Is a quote. Now, this had a pretty... The absinthe has a pretty bad effect on his general temperament. Mm-hmm. Like, the more he drinks, the worse of a person he becomes. Because sometimes this is how hallucinogens work.
Right, yeah. I don't know, a whole lot of people are like, I really need some hallucinogens to just... like, put me in the right space.
I just got to even out.
Driving.
Yeah. Please. Give me a little bit of X. I will even out. It's going to be cool.
I can't parallel park unless I have a lot of ketamine in me. Then it's weird.
This is exactly why. Go ahead.
I just see all the geometry in my head. I can't screw it up now.
This is 100% of the reason why Elon was like, oh, the Tesla will auto park. Because he's so ramped up on ketamine. Yeah. He's like, I can't park this car. Like, the car needs to parallel park for me. So you get it. So that's not helping him be a good person. Mm-hmm. And then he becomes abusive towards Sarah, physically and emotionally. And this is leaving her, among other things, terrified.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And Oliver found her terror very distasteful.
Oh, absolutely.
So so he does what any normal, sane, definitely sober person does, and he abandons her on their honeymoon.
In Paris.
Mm-hmm. And he starts traveling around France with a dancer.
I need a honeymoon from this honeymoon. You know what I mean? It's getting a little too real here.
Oh, and another little fun treat. A little bit after this, Sarah learns she's pregnant with Oliver's child.
Oh.
So poor Sarah is in the worst possible position. They divorce. Oliver was then forbidden by Sarah from ever seeing his daughter.
Okay.
His name is Natika. And Oliver, who actually is now giving very strong Elon vibes, he says, oh, you don't want me to see her? Guess what? I disown her. She's not my daughter. So she tells everyone she's not his daughter. He does disown her. He disinherits her for all his money. And that was fine with Sarah, who was very happy at this point to be rid of Oliver. When she was old enough to understand such things, this was also fine with Natika. And you'll be happy to know both Sarah and Natika were, they did just fine without Oliver. Sarah remarried a person who, as far as I can tell, was quite nice and wealthy. And then Natika also married someone who, as far as I can tell, quite nice, very wealthy. So they did all right.
What are the odds? I mean, like, seriously.
They found the two people. And good for them. And they deserved it. So even though that first marriage only lasted a couple months, Oliver, he didn't let it get him down. You know, he's ready to go. A lot of fish in that sea. He lives the bachelor life then for quite a while, for quite a few years. Eventually, he does go to work for Daddy August at the banking company, August Belmont and Company. But in 1890, Oliver's father dies. And by the way, I'll note that, like, even though this is prime time, the Civil War never came up in the research once. So this is how rich people, I guess, are living.
Yeah.
They're just not even concerning themselves with the shit. So 1890, Oliver's father dies, and so Oliver, therefore, inherits just an absolute fortune. He did have some siblings, but August was so wealthy. I mean, he's basically like a lawyer for the Rothschild Empire. Yeah. So, you know, there's a lot of cash. So Oliver has a ton of money. He's living the bachelor lifestyle still. He decides the first thing he wants to do with his money is build a fuck palace. Sorry, this is summer house. Summer house. Sorry, summer house. He wants to build a summer house.
He's like quickly painting over the fuck palace sign. Like, no, my mom's coming. No, no.
Before Zillow gets here to take sides. Before they get here to take the photos, I gotta take the bound town sign off the bed. No. Let me ask you. Okay, so he chooses a location. Now, if let's say it's you, it's 1890. Mm-hmm. You're super wealthy. Mm-hmm. You're building pound town. Mm-hmm. Where do you put it?
I'm in New York City.
You live. I don't. That's a good question. Let's say yes. Let's say yes. New York City.
I probably put it in Portland, Maine. The sexiest city in New England.
I asked the wrong person for sure. Absolutely. I'll give you a hint. This is one of your, if not your least favorite states of all time.
Ooh, least favorite state. Gosh, I mean, Vermont kind of sucks. But
now you've mentioned this on this podcast as a state you fucking hate, and I don't know why.
Rhode Island? No, they yes. Rhode Island. Oh, terrible choice. There you go.
Oh. He chooses Newport, Rhode Island. Now, I didn't really look Newport up on a map. I don't know if we saw that or not.
It's like the other city in Rhode Island.
Oh,
it's not Providence.
So we didn't go there, and it is basically an island, on an island.
Okay.
In Rhode Island. So it will not, it's the island part of Rhode Island. So it will not surprise you to learn that at this point, there were just tons of rich people buying and building gigantic fucking houses in Newport. So he chooses that as well. He hires an architect named Richard Morris Hunt, and you may not be familiar with that name. I also was not. Are you familiar with the name?
No. He's not one of my my known architects.
Name all of your known architects.
The guy that did the waterfall house.
Uh huh. And his name was.
Him. The guy that
one of the most probably the most famous architect of all time.
Right. Yeah. Him. That's the one.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know his name.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Robert Louis Stevenson.
That's not okay.
That's fine. And Eno Saarinen, the guy that designed the arch. There's two.
So you know one, right. And it's not Frank Lloyd Wright.
Frank Lloyd Wright,
the guy who designed the arch.
I thought it was Robert Louis Stevenson. Anyway, they both have three names. But no, so those two, Frank Lloyd Wright, okay. Eno Saarinen. That's it.
Okay, so. This was different than that, so you don't know his name.
This is the third guy.
But you are familiar with his work. He designed, among many other things, the Biltmore Estate.
I was going to guess the Biltmore architect. Okay.
I
seriously was.
He also designed the pedestal of the Statue of Liberty.
Well, I mean...
It's not like a house.
Yeah.
I could design a fucking pedestal for a statue.
I got an idea. We're going to pour a lot of concrete to put the statue on. All right. Thank you very much. Can you write a check out? Yeah.
Let me say this. All right. Go with me here. Block. Huh?
Right. But a small block won't work. Right. That's why we're going to do a big block.
Big fucking block. and a lot of other big stuff too, but yeah, the Biltmore Estate, I think is is a big one. So he's a big deal, especially at this time, contemporary times. And another fun fact,
wham,
he was born in Brattleboro, Vermont.
Oh,
this time I'm only going to offer 3 iTag points because you're not very good at this game. Do you remember where we've heard Brattleboro, Vermont before?
Ooh. Oh, Brattleboro, Vermont. I don't. I really don't.
Boy, it's like you're not even paying attention.
The wiki has nothing on Vermont. I'll have to go back and double check it.
The Brattleboro, Vermont, factored into the Brattleboro Retreat episode, which is the one where the people at the mental health institution built the giant tower
to jump
on. They're
off
like, this will definitely make people feel pretty good. And then they were surprised to learn people were actually just jumping off of it a lot. And that was Brattleboro. So anyway, so that's where we start. So Oliver, so he hires Hunt, and Hunt comes in with some pretty, you know, obviously some pretty great ideas on how to design this mansion. Mm-hmm. Oliver looks at the plans and says, actually, I'll be designing the mansion. You just build it.
Okay.
Quote, Hunt was hesitant with the design of Belcourt, which is what we'll end up calling the mansion. But he concentrated on his guiding principle that it was his client's money he was spending.
If you could just put down the absinthe bottle long enough to draw a straight line, that's all I need you to do. That's all.
The amount of money he must have spent on the most famous architect in America at this time, just to tell him, actually, I've done this already. Astounding. So they build the house according to Oliver's plans. The first floor of the house was mostly stables.
That's really what you want below all of the rooms of your house. Horses. Lots and lots of horses.
You know, you may know this. Normally, stables are like separate from the house.
Really far away from the house.
Quite
because
far.
They're awful. Just terrible.
Not here. No, no. The first floor was almost exclusively horse stables. In the master bedroom, the walls were painted with scenes depicting the life of a nobleman. This guy is so insufferable. Again, big Elon vibes. The overall design of the house is mainly French Renaissance and Gothic.
Oh.
Which I don't think are two styles.
Those don't go together real well. No.
See together.
The French Renaissance wasn't like a response to Gothic architecture, essentially.
I think it was intentionally the opposite of Gothic architecture, if I remember correctly.
I want this room to be both red and blue. I don't really know how you're going to make that work, but I want both.
Not alternating, just both.
Yeah.
There's also some Italian influence in there, some German, some English.
Mm-hmm.
Weird place. Would you like to see some photos?
I would love to. Sounds like the Graceland.
I was thinking, I don't know if we talked about this before or not, but when my parents were out visiting, we went to Monticello to see Thomas Jefferson's home, which was a really cool experience. But the house itself is so weird. And you walk through and it's like, none of this makes sense. Individually, the pieces are all super interesting and like, but it's like nothing matches, nothing works together. It's all very weird. Like in his bedroom, you walk into the room and there are these three gigantic circles just cut into the wall. And it's like, why are there holes in this wall? And it's because he put his closet in the wall, but high up. So he had to take a ladder into the wall to go to his closet, and the circles are there cut into the wall so that some light would come into the room, and that's the only light source. And it's like, what the fuck are you thinking? It's all so weird. Anyway, so this is a picture of the house.
Ooh, I like this. I love the houses that have a courtyard in the middle. I love that.
Yes, love a house with a courtyard in the middle, for sure. That's where your kids can go play, and you don't have to worry about anything.
Just go to the yard. He did choose to have the funeral home awning on the front door. I don't like that. Not a good choice there.
I'm not sure that was original to the design, but oh man. So that's the house, obviously, from the outside. So this is one of the rooms, which I guess.
Oh wow! Beautiful vaulted ceiling.
It's a gray vaulted ceiling. Very great. Got the French flag hanging there for reasons, probably. Here's a different room that is way different.
Okay, sure. This is just like this Rob the Vatican and grab whatever that wasn't nailed down.
And put it in some like fucking German weird-ass, very dark wood closet. Giant closet.
This was my favorite scene from Inglourious Basterds when they lit this room on fire. Favorite scene.
Yep. Here's another room.
Okay.
Maybe more French Gilded Age?
Sure. Yeah, it's got some weird Versailles themes to it with like the gold wallpaper and gold tables. Mm-hmm.
Lots of flourishes on the furniture, and also the blood red carpet and chairs, which is very Versailles at the end stages. Mm-hmm. Also, this one column. Right. It's like, okay. And then here's a picture of one of the carriage houses that was part of the stables. Hmm. And again, this is the first floor of the living area.
Right.
That is the house.
No, I do get it. You know, nowadays people do like the garage attached to the house. It's very convenient. I get it.
That's true. But now, very forward thinking.
But imagine if your car just shit 70 pounds of poop every single day. At some point, you wouldn't keep the car in the basement anymore. You'd be like,
this no, I would keep it in the neighbor's driveway for sure. For sure. So that's the house. It's great. Beautiful and full of stuff. That is fine. And that's the house. Now, construction cost $3.2 million in 1894, oof, which is about $117 million today.
Man.
Oliver named the mansion Bell Court, presumably because it's where Oliver Belmont would hold court or whatever. I'm guessing, yep. But that feels right to me. This is flat. It's just so attracted to this computer. Belcourt was set to open with a huge fucking dumb festival of rich people in July of 1894. But unfortunately, I mean, just before, like days before he left New York for Newport to open the house, Oliver got mugged.
Okay.
And he got mugged so hard that he had to go to the hospital for several weeks.
Ooh, goodness.
The mugger, they caught him. His name was, let me see here. Is this right? Karma.
Hmm, interesting.
Right? Yes, Karma mugged him. So he's in the hospital for a while. His health is generally not great. Because he's...
Yeah, because of the absence, primarily.
So
yeah,
fucking absent. So even though he's in his 30s, he's not healthy. And he's got the absinthe, probably some arsenic, because that was a cool thing to just drink at the time. And it takes him almost a full year to fully recover.
Wow. Oof.
So he can't actually open Belcourt until September 2nd, 1895. He's like opening the summer house on Labor Day.
Yeah.
But he does open it, and he has a huge party for all his rich idiot friends, where he gave out $7,000 worth of party favors.
Oh, wow.
Which is today about $262,000.
So he wasn't like going down to Dollar Tree and getting all the stupid shit for your kid's birthday party.
No, we live very different lives. No, he was not. He was not.
Don't forget to take your bag of stuff you're going to throw away when you get home. There you go. Here's...
And then 2 days later, your kids will say, "Where's that blow toy?
Where's that bag of pencils and the annoying whistle?" Yeah, I threw all that shit away. I'm so sorry. Nobody wants
there
that.
There was an eraser shaped like an eraser. I need it. So has a huge blowout bash, but it's September. There goes my pen. Mm-hmm. So as soon as he opens the house, he closes it again.
Hmm.
So he's not like a planner.
Right.
Actually kind of dumb and bad at stuff as we've covered. Now, a few months later in January of 1896, Oliver remarries.
Hmm.
This time he marries a woman named Alva Vanderbilt.
Oh, I've heard of this. I've heard of this person.
You've heard of Alva Vanderbilt?
I've heard of Vanderbilt.
Okay, yeah. Yeah. That, sure. Listen, don't pat yourself on the back. We've all heard of the Vanderbilts. Now, Alva Vanderbilt, she is not a Vanderbilt by birth. She is actually the ex-wife of Oliver's very good former friend, William Vanderbilt, who is part of the Vanderbilt clan.
Right.
They're very close. They're very good friends. Mm-hmm. And then Oliver marries his ex-wife.
Hmm. Well.
they are no longer very close friends at that point. Because part of the reason they got divorced, but possibly, is because Alva and Oliver were, it was pretty clear that they were into each other from years back. Now, I want to show you this photo of Alva for what will, I think, when you see it, become very obvious reasons. Here is Alva.
Oh, okay. Are the birds attacking her?
I'm it's confused. Hard to know. Yeah. It's hard to know.
I think she's snapping one bird's neck and the other one she's pinning to the floor. I don't know.
It's hard to know if this is the picture that was the inspiration for the birds or for the Three Amigos.
The hat is it's a very Three Amigos hat. I will give you that.
It's a very
Three Amigos hat. Three Amigos hat. So even the backdrop of the photo appears to be like a huge flock of birds attacking someone else. This is a very intense photo. This is lots to take in.
So you would like that. So that's Alva. So they get married. Now this causes a bit of a social scandal, but they don't care. Oliver, he's deep in love with Alva and vice versa. They're into each other in such a big way that as a wedding present, Oliver gifts Alva the brand new Belcourt Castle.
Huh.
He gives her the house.
Interesting. How do you give someone a house? Like, are you expected to also be able to visit the house?
Well, they're married, so I think it's like the assumption is like you'll own this, and I assume that it's cool if I'm here.
Right. I guess I'm unclear on the rules of marriage at this point. Like,
not a bad question.
If it were Amy's birthday, and I was like, hey, this kind of lines up with the day that we're going to buy our house. How about if I just get you this house for your birthday? You know what she's going to say?
Get out of my house.
That doesn't count. Yeah. This doesn't count as a birthday present. That's what she's going to say.
What do you mean it doesn't count as a birthday present? Because here's what we do. You would sign. You wouldn't. Your name would not be on the mortgage.
Oh, see, this is a bad idea. Yeah.
And actually, that's, the burden then is on her, huh? All right. Let's say, okay, new scenario. Uh-huh. You're buying the house fully in cash.
Mm-hmm.
So she doesn't have a mortgage.
Right.
And you say, my name's not going on the deed to this house. It's just yours.
Right. It's a risky play.
Oh, yeah. For you? Yeah, for
very
sure.
Risky.
For sure. and you know, knowing Oliver's history with wives, I'm sure it'll be fine. So he gifts her the mansion. She commenced renovations almost immediately.
Oh, on the brand new house.
The brand new house that he designed himself. Mm-hmm. So she's like, thank you so much. Yeah. Love this house. Yeah. It is garbage.
Yeah. We have to fix bones. It. It has great bones.
So she starts renovating, but Oliver doesn't care. He's happy. He's rich. He's in love. Life is so good. And eventually he feels a little like listless. Like maybe you should like get a job.
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah.
Do any boats need like a midshipman or
need a really low ranking, poorly trained, real dipshit officer? I'm your guy.
Yeah.
No, it's not gonna be that. He just needs what could it be? He just needs something that like I don't know. What do you do when you're like, okay, when you're super rich, kinda dumb, no work ethic.
Mm-hmm.
God, if there's any, what kind of job?
Personally, I would buy a social media company. That's what I would do if
You're not too far off.
Does he buy a newspaper?
What do you say? Yeah, he becomes a politician.
Ah, okay. Well, fair enough. Okay.
In 1900, he is elected to Congress representing New York's 13th district. And here, for your viewing pleasure, is a pretty cool lapel pin that he had made of himself.
Oliver H.P. Belmont for Congress.
He just fucking looks insufferable, doesn't he?
He looks like he is, not a care in the world, including for you. That's the look I get from that right there.
Yeah, absolutely. So he goes to Congress and he serves one term.
Also grows bored with congressional work.
He was not a candidate for renomination in 1902. But for all of Oliver's faults, and we've talked about several, I will say this: while he was in Congress, he did advocate for inheritance tax.
Oh,
which I mean feels like, on the one hand, very surprising and positive. On the other hand, it's like, well, he already got his inheritance; like he's not going to get taxed.
he has no children at this point, right?
Right.
Yeah. So yeah, sure. Fuck them.
Yeah. Why not? He advocates for inheritance tax, public ownership of public works, and the power of the people to veto any law by Congress. Alrighty. So, I mean, I guess we would say progressive.
I would say so, yeah.
Bordering on like actual communism, which is surprising. So, you know, good for him. But then he leaves and he goes back to doing basically nothing. So he did run a weekly paper called The Verdict for a while. So yes, he does get into newspapers. But at this point, of course, like everyone is in a fucking vanity paper. So mostly he dedicates his time to renovating and improving Belcourt to his wife's wishes, which, he wouldn't have to do if he had let Richard Hunt just fucking design the house. Now, they hold some wonderful parties there. For example, in 1907, they hold a dinner party for Consul, a chimpanzee.
Wait, what?
I think I'm going to answer some of your questions here in a second.
Okay.
Here are some of the details of that dinner, and this comes from the New York Times. Headline, Consul, chimpanzee, Mr. Belmont's guest, breakfasts in a dignified manner at Belcourt, the Newport Villa. Refuses a black cigar, but smokes a cigarette with evident enjoyment. Many society people are present.
Oh.
And I've got some quotes from the story. Do you want to weigh in before we get into that?
Is this a special chimpanzee? Is this smoking maybe what sets him apart? I'm kind of confused.
It's hard to say.
Yeah.
I think he was a circus chimpanzee.
Okay. maybe a star of stage and screen as well, or
possibly he was great in blackface. Really, really brought it home. I know. So here are some quotes from the New York Times article. Consul began his perusal of the bill of fare. It included bouillon, roast chicken, sirloin steak with accompanying dishes, tea, champagne, and coffee. The chimpanzee thoroughly enjoyed the meal, showing an especial fondness for the champagne. So they're letting this chimpanzee get ripped.
Get ripped shit. Smoke cigarettes at the dinner table. I mean, I think it's kind of his mansion now is what it sounds like to me. Like,
I think that's right.
What do you do if this chimpanzee is like, I'm not leaving?
This is the plot of Dunstan Checks In, I think.
It absolutely is. Yep. Then Dunstan eats the guy's face off, and you're like, okay, well, this is Dunstan's hotel now.
Well, that's, yeah. I guess we all have to eat faces off. One other quote from that story. When at the close of the meal, a black cigar was offered him, he bit off the end and, taking one taste of the weed, threw it away. He was consoled, however, with a cigarette, which he lighted and smoked with very evident enjoyment. So things are going great.
I don't know how much absinthe I would have to drink to give a chimpanzee a lighter in my home. I mean, my God. That's...
absolutely not. This guy is definitely the RFK Jr. of his day. Mm-hmm.
Then dumps the chimpanzee's body on the New Jersey Turnpike at 4 a.m.
And we'll tell everyone in 10 years. Mm. Oh, man. So it's going well until June 10th, 1908, when Oliver Belmont dies.
Oh.
Following... He dies following complications from a delayed appendectomy. So this dipshit's appendix burst. They try to rush him to the hospital, and he's like, well, not so fast.
Yeah.
I've got time. I want to finish some things up first. Turns out he did not have time. And then he died. So anyway, obviously Alva owns the mansion. She has control of the mansion. So she has it until her death in 1933, but they never had children, and obviously he disowned his one actual child. Mm-hmm. So when she dies, Belcourt passes to Oliver's older brother, Perry. Perry?
Perry?
Perry? Perry, you have a mansion? Also a pretty good seller, by the way, is the home movies inspired chair. Perry's 80 years old.
Uh-huh.
So he's...
That's exactly what he wants. A big fucking headache out in Rhode Island.
Responsibility, yeah. For sure. Now, he doesn't want the house, but he never liked Alva, so he is interested in changing the house to soil her memory. He immediately sells everything in the house that he identifies as hers. But by 1940, Perry's officially sick of owning Belcourt and dealing with it, so he decides to sell it. And he starts talking with a man named George Waterman. Now, Waterman really wants to buy Belcourt because he wants to turn it into an antique auto museum.
What?
I've given you all the information I have.
I'm looking for a home whose entire first floor still kind of smells like shit, but is primed for 200 exotic imported cars.
Now, I know there are multiple levels of this house, right, and I will not be able to bring cars up to them. Mm-hmm. We'll figure that out later. We'll put stuff up there.
All of the car staff will stay in those upper floors.
So Perry's like, sure, man, I don't care. Yeah. So he says he will sell it to Waterman, but there's a condition, and that condition is that Waterman has to restore the castle to Hunt's original plans.
Very nice. Yeah.
Which makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Finally, someone in the family
realizes this whole family's fucked up. Please just do away with all these awful decisions.
Yeah. Waterman agrees. And for agreeing, he's gonna buy Belcourt for a fucking song. So Perry, he's not looking to make money. He wants to just offload it, but he's trying to restore the house to its original potential. Also, Perry is just rich as fuck, so he doesn't he doesn't care. So he only asks Waterman for $1,000.
Oof. In today's dollars, that's like
$22,000.
Okay.
Which is nothing for this house.
I could swing that. Yeah. I could easily swing that.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. For sure. Yeah. Oh, 5% down on that? Yeah. Yeah, I could do that. I think so. Can we do a 30-year? But $20,000 for this giant mansion is really good. So Waterman's like, hell yeah, I'll do that. So he buys Belcourt for $1,000, and he starts renovations. He gets as far as restoring. He restores the third floor roof. And he removes an addition that Alva had made to the courtyard before learning that the zoning committee would not allow him to make the building into an antique auto museum.
$1,000 down the drain.
Ah! So he immediately sells it to a man named Edward Dunn. Now, Edward Dunn never lives there. He just owns it. And during World War II, he rents the stables to the military. Now, they don't use horses much.
Right, yeah. Especially not on...
In Newport.
Yeah.
For World War II. But it's... they use it for repairing equipment because it's giant open first floor space. But in 1954, Dunn sells Belcourt to Lewis and Elaine Lorillard. Lorillard.
Terrible name.
Lorillard.
Lorillard. Yeah. You keep saying it, but it's not going to get better.
No. No. Terrible name, but they do have that tobacco money. And they want to use Belcourt as the home of the Newport Jazz Festival.
Oh.
Now, Newport Jazz Festival is a big deal. Perhaps you've heard of it. These are the folks who started that festival way back when. And they want to use Belcourt as the home for that. Now, I will say that's not a good idea because this is a giant indoor building. And Jazz Festival is famously outdoors. Yeah. So, again, so much space. I mean, a nice backdrop. But what are you doing in this space? So they buy it. They host the festival there for a year or two. But the neighbors start to complain because they are all wealthy asshats also. Yeah. And they don't like sounds.
A lot of these songs sound like they're about us. I don't really.
No, thank you. So the neighbors are very vocal about their displeasure here. So eventually, it's not long before they're like, fuck it, we'll just sell it. Plus, the castle itself, at this point in time, is basically, it's been uninhabited for 2 decades. Mm-hmm. So it's a wreck.
Yeah.
So after just 2 years, the Lorillards are like, fuck it. They sell Belcourt to the Tinney family. Now, the Tinney family, they officially changed the name of the building from Belcourt to Belcourt Castle. And I will note, I don't know how you change the name of a house. I don't know how you name a house officially. I don't know how you change the name of a house officially.
I think you just chisel into the cornerstone down there, right?
Is that it?
Yeah. That's all it is.
Do all houses have cornerstones?
Mine does.
Does it have like a stone?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. What have you chiseled into your cornerstone?
No fat chicks.
Emails about that. Thanks a lot. Hey, everyone. Don't email me. Patrick doesn't have access to the email. Only I do. And
I don't have a cornerstone in my house. Okay.
But also, we do have a motto, which is Jesus Christ. Okay, so Tinney family. Oh, change name. So they change name and they fill it with their own collection of antiques and reproductions.
Mm.
So they're bringing a lot of genuinely very valuable stuff into the house. Now, this is where some of the things you saw in the earlier photos actually come to play, including that there was a big chandelier, which you may remember. Mm-hmm. It holds 13,000 crystal prisms and 105 lights.
Ugh. At least two are always burned out. You fix those two.
God damn it! Just change these. They bring in Persian rugs, French royal art, Oriental art. Again, not my term. religious artifacts, all kinds of shit. And unlike previous owners, the Tinneys actually move in.
Mm.
So they treat the house as a museum, but also a museum where they live. Mm. And they start doing tours. Now, the Tinneys own it for a long time. They own it from 1954 until the 2000s. In 2008, Belcourt was put up for sale by Harley Tinney, one of the daughters, for $7.2 million.
Mm.
Now, I will remind you that in present-day money, this thing costs more than $100 million to build.
Right.
And she's like, please, someone take this for $7 million. A year later, she reduces the price to $5.1 million.
Mm.
The next year, down to $3.9 million.
Mm.
There are still no buyers, so she takes it off the market. Then she relists the whole thing as two separate land parcels, one with the house, one without.
Mm-hmm.
Still, no one is interested. And the reason Harley was so eager to sell, and the reason everyone else in the world was not ready to buy, was because Harley had been very public about the fact the mansion was incredibly haunted. And in fact, in 2010, while she was trying to sell the house, Harley published a book called The Ghosts of Belcourt Castle, which is a big strategic error,
oh, yeah, I think. Yeah. And as well as her sequel, The Cracked Foundation of Belcourt Castle. The Bedbug Infestation.
The Many Floods.
The complicated foreclosure status of Belcourt Mansion.
The weird zoning issues of Belcourt Castle. It's a 10-book series, and it's riveting, but not a great idea.
Yeah.
This book details quite a few ghosts, actually. So there are two Gothic chairs in the grand ballroom, which we saw in one of the photos. Mm. They are now, as of now, they're roped off. So if you go on a tour, you cannot get close to them. Mm-hmm. But there was a time when you could just walk right up to them. You could touch them. And everyone who did touch them felt that the surface was as cold as ice.
Ooh.
One woman on a tour of the castle tried to sit in one of the chairs and was thrown across the room. there's also a 15th century suit of armor that moves and screams.
Mm. I like that.
And it's kind of fun. I have a photo of that suit of armor if you'd like to see it. Let's do this. There you go.
Oh, that looks like a screaming one. Yeah.
For sure.
That's definitely a screaming one. Yeah. Yeah.
I can't explain why, but something about it is...
It is the fact that it doesn't have a spot for your face. The face
or hands.
Or hand, yeah. The face is just like a piece of solid, you know, sheet metal. There's no, like, eye holes or ear, anything. It's just literally, you hop in here and there's no sensory organs pointing out at that point.
No. The only escape is mouth.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
This is, it gives real strong Resident Evil vibes for me, and I don't know why. It's like Pyramid Head from Resident Evil
in
ways I can't really explain, but I feel deeply. So that's haunted, obviously. At one point, the Tinneys bought a wooden sculpture of a monk, which was another antique for the collection.
Mm-hmm.
And soon afterward, they started seeing the apparition of the actual monk.
Mm.
He first appeared in Harley's bedroom. Religious people, am I right? He also appears in the chapel, busying himself with preparations for mass, and sometimes he wanders down the grand staircase. Alva Belmont herself haunts the second floor gallery, dressed in a ball gown, which is a fine way to be remembered. Now, Harley's husband, Donald, has seen the ghosts of two girls dancing in that same ballroom. And a British soldier in dress uniform wanders through the house sometimes. This one might stem from the fact that Belcourt was apparently inadvertently built over land that was once a graveyard from the Revolution. The bodies were moved, but
they always say that, you know.
Yeah, Oh, we did move the bodies. You gave us $5,000. Yeah. We moved so many bodies.
$5 a body. Doing it all day long. They all got moved.
Yeah, every single one. We checked for sure,
We took a big stick and we poked it down and we come up and we licked it and nope. And then to go over and we poke it down again and we pick it up. Nope, none either. Gross. All day long. Gross. Anyway, $50, please.
I licked it. God. I mentioned the Oriental artifacts. Well, one ghost attached to those pieces is a samurai warrior who moves around that particular room.
Ooh.
Which is terrifying, but also pretty fucking cool.
Very Tom Cruise.
Very Tom Cruise. Oh, man. Let's see. We went so long without any Last Samurai references, and now it's two in one night.
That's a shame.
Hey, I'll tell you what. Ken Watanabe, huh? Mm-hmm. What an actor.
Made it.
That guy is something. Anyway, where are we here? One night, Donald Tinney starts having a conversation with someone that Harley couldn't see. It was, quote, as though I was listening to one side of a telephone conversation. Her husband said, yes, Tom, of course, Tom, I will. The next day, they learned their friend Tom Wilson had died during the night.
Ooh.
Oliver Belmont, the man himself, he is sometimes seen, but he's more often heard shouting, get out, to people who tour the house. Which is the energy I think I would want to bring.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I would wake up at the crack of dawn. I'd get like a mile jogging. I'd come back to the house and I'd just scream at everyone to get the fuck out until closing.
He's never been more relatable than he is as a ghost. For sure. Now, eventually, Harley does sell Belcourt. It's purchased by Carolyn Raphaelian for $3.6 million. She uses it as a tour house, art gallery, and event space.
Whew.
Carolyn is trying to distance the house from its reputation of being haunted. However, that attempt is not being helped by the fact that visitors are still seeing the ghosts everywhere. And they keep telling her, and she keeps saying it's not haunted, and they keep saying, oh, yeah, it fucking is. And this week we're going to go out on a fun fact.
Wham!
Oof. In 1999, the Tinneys rented out the mansion to a group who held a no underwear party, which is, yes, indeed, exactly what it sounds like.
Okay.
That is the story of Belcourt Mansion. Any questions or concerns?
I had some question about the no underwear party, but then I was thinking, how many parties have I been to that were no underwear parties? That, you know, I was the only one aware that it was a no underwear party.
Yeah, so any party can be no underwear party if you want it to be. And that is Belcourt Mansion. What a story, huh?
Hmm.
This is one that was really fun because I researched the story and I was like, this is interesting. I'm taking notes. And then it was kind of a rare situation where, like, the more I read on different sites, it's like different sites are giving more details about Oliver's life and the ghost that are all like, oh, this site didn't mention any of, like, this wild shit, like the abuse of his first wife and the fact that he left her and disowned his daughter and like went on a tour of France with a dancer. So it was like a blooming onion, the blooming onion of stories. It just opens itself and there are so many layers. And that was something. Any final thoughts on this story?
Oh man, just maybe giving me half a reason to visit Rhode Island, not a full reason.
I will never understand why you hate Rhode Island so much.
It's so small.
I know, but you're so small.
And Providence just sucks. So it's.
I liked it a lot. I thought it was a great drive. We drove through it. It was small, and fine.
No. Never going to go back.
There are so many worse states. There are so many worse states.
But this one concentrates its badness in like a really small spot.
We spent like an hour in
the
state.
We spent enough time in that state.
Okay. All right. Well, we're going to get out of here before Patrick roids out and just becomes Red Hulk. So I will say all the notes this week on Is This a Ghost are taken by me, Clayton Smith. All the funny jokes are from Patrick Dean. Our audio editor is Jeremy Montoya. Our video editor is Jen Swanson. Our social media manager, I guess, is still Kai Valonis. I'll be honest, I have not heard from her in months. and it's been several weeks since she's posted. So I hope everything's good with Kai. And that's my wish for tonight is that Kai is doing okay.
The Kai is not our next subject.
I wasn't gonna say that, but I guess we should send the podcast, huh?